nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, well, today we're going to, on Lecture 8 of the course, we're going to talk about surface chemistry. It's sometimes called bioconjugation because most of the time we're trying to do the chemistry of biomolecules to the surface of nanomaterials. And what I'm going to do today is not try to tell you all of the possible bioconjugation chemistry that you could possibly do, but as always, the purpose of the course is to give you a framework. And what I'm going to try to do is put bioconjugation chemistry in perspective for you and show you what to watch out for and some of the hazards, if you will, of doing certain approaches that may look on the surface to be very appealing but will eventually get you into trouble further down the road. So as a start of this, I'm going to sort of introduce the concept and talk about a little bit about the variations with core materials. And then I'm going to go immediately into at least sort of overriding surface chemistry strategies. And that's pretty much the idea of having a strategy for this surface chemistry is important because you're building an entire device. You're building a little machine, a complex machine that has many different components in it. And each time you do the chemistry, you kind of set the limitations as well as the possibilities for the next stage. So I'd rather see you set possibilities than limitations. We'll talk about two main strategies, one being a covalent chemistry strategy, and I'll talk about some simple approaches to that. There are certainly a lot of non-simple approaches, but what I'm going to do, the main thing I'm going to give there as a strategy is to avoid harsh organic solvents, because when you're going to be around human cells, particularly for in vivo treatments, you just don't want to put in organic solvents that are very hard to take out again. And then there are a number of non-covalent strategies that are based more on electrostatics and on basically phobicity driving a thermodynamic assembly at the surface that will not require a conjugation chemistry, but will in fact assemble a structure for you. And I'll talk about some of the advantages and disadvantages of each of those. And then we'll talk about some special considerations because we have to worry about things like steric hindrance and how to get accessibility and how to test for whether we've really done something. We have to make room for the targeting molecules, which, as we talked about last time about zeta potential, we have to be able to reach across an electric potential barrier. And if we can't do that because we've messed up the surface chemistry in a way that we don't have the accessibility of the targeting molecules for their cell surface receptors, then we can pretty much be a showstopper in our design. And then again, ways of testing that. Again, always when you build something, if you don't have a way of testing it, you're running blind. So I'm always going to be emphasizing that. And then I'll go through a little bit about some of the common targeting molecules, such as antibodies, peptides, aptamers, and talk about some of the simpler ways to do the attachment chemistry. And then basically talking a little bit about the whole complex and what happens to it as you build these rather complex structures. And then lastly, talking about pharmacodynamics, which are largely unknown. Very little has been done with looking at what actually happens in the body and biodistribution and kinetics of nanoparticle-based therapies. There's a little bit of literature, mostly based on liposomes, but only part of that is going to be applicable because typically those liposomes are much, much larger structures. So, and then I'm giving you a number of different references, and you'll hear me refer often to Kumar, And this is a very excellent reference. It's one of the best ones that I've found. It's a book on bioconjugation chemistry, where they've, again, it's written by a number of different authors, but it pulls it together pretty well in one booklet. So I will borrow, you know, some material out of this, and you're welcome to also, we can make perhaps limited copies of chapters for specific individuals here that you, if you have a need of those. So let's go ahead and get into today's lecture. And what I'm going to do is try to give you an overview, and then with our onion skin approach, we'll kind of go a little deeper and a little deeper until we get down to the level where all of this makes sense, where we set the larger picture and then give you enough structure so that when you read and you think about these things, that you are sort of thinking in the right direction. So if we think about basic attachment strategies, the first thing that you run into is that your attachment strategy is going to be fairly critically dependent on whatever you choose as your nanomaterial core material. That will tend to drive the rest of the structure. But one of the things that I really want to make clear to you is don't let the whole attachment strategy be driven by a desire to make something the simplest first step, because you may save on that simple first step to the particular nano core material, but then thereafter you may have limited your entire complex. There's going to be a lot of things that you won't be able to do. For example, if you were, a lot of people, you'll see vast quantities of literature choose gold nanoparticles because the surface chemistry is particularly easy. On the other hand, there's a lot of things that you can't do with gold, such as it's not a magnetic resonance imaging agent. It doesn't have magnetic properties, so you can't use magnetic fields to increase concentration. Local drug concentration. There's a lot of issues there. So that's not a good reason to design your whole complex just because you want the first step to be easy. So think about the choice of the core. Design your whole structure. Your choice of your core should depend on what you're trying to accomplish. And it may be a little harder at the initial, core functionalization, but thereafter, then you have a structure that will do what you want it to do. And I see so many people limit themselves at this point just because they're afraid to pick what would be a better core material for their overall strategy here. Now, surface chemistry for biomolecules on this core material, almost all of the nanomaterials are pretty hydrophobic, which means to even get them into an aqueous environment, we have to take a number of strategies to make them hydrophilic enough to go in a water environment. And so quite often those first steps, the addition of molecules for biocompatibility, because cells do not like highly hydrophobic nanomaterial structures. So part of the strategy for putting biomolecules for biocompatibility also simultaneously usually satisfy putting biomolecules that make the nanomaterials more hydrophilic and that will disperse in a fluid. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a huge agglomerated complex, and you won't be able to use it. We can think about, when we think about these attachment chemistries, you may be very much focused, or I would say sometimes over-focused, on trying to get the initial molecule onto the nanomaterial core. But you've got to think about, well, what's your next step? So it's quite often a good idea to think about not a monofunctional molecule, but a bifunctional molecule. In other words, what you're doing is you're putting links, in one sense, linking back to the core material, but you want to put a link out for the next step, for the next molecule that you want to add. So we'll talk, and I'll show you some. There's a variety of materials, and even some, for example, even polyethylene glycol that is made to be bifunctional, so that you can attach it at both ends and then put a targeting molecule out on the other end of it. So there's a lot of interesting things you can do. So don't get hung up on monofunctional chemistry at one end of the molecule and forget that you're going to have to do something for the next step. So set yourself out as a series of steps. So beginning with the end in mind, as we say. We'll mention a lot in terms of pegylation as a stealth strategy, just because pegylation has proven to be a huge benefit for increasing the circulation time, even of fairly conventional drugs. So a lot of things have been put into pegylated complexes to increase their circulation time. And that's well known. It's already been well studied for human use. So the only things that are different there are that you will have to pick some form of polyethylene glycol that is appropriate for your purpose. And there are many polyethylene glycols. Some with very branched structures, some with simple structures. And as you get into the somewhat branched structures, then those also, the pegylation, what it basically does, it prevents, partly by steric hindrance, the collection of proteins onto the surface of your nanoparticle complexes. And we've mentioned that before, that process of protein deposition is a really destructive process to your whole strategy, because it's going to see that they're fairly rapidly taken out of the body by the reticuloendothelial system. So if we want to increase circulation time, we will have some kind, typically, of a PEG or equivalent molecule on the outer part of the complex. But again, thinking about that as a one strategy that we use a lot in our lab is bifunctional polyethylene glycol complexes, so that we have a hook on each end of the polyethylene glycol. And that can be, that part can be purchased as a reagent and go right into your overall strategy. And then, as again, always thinking from the last lecture, always thinking about zeta potential, because every time you add these molecules to the surface of your nanoparticle, and you may have multiple layers, you're going to be changing the zeta potential of the overall particle. And you've got to keep the zeta potential in the right regime to do what you want it to do. Otherwise, you can have it agglomerate, you can have it change to a zeta potential that'll stick all over everything and completely negate your targeting. So be thinking about that. And typically, as you're constructing these things, you should be checking the zeta potential after each layer that you put on. So if you do bioconjugation chemistry, I'll show you some examples of that. Some of the molecules that you put on can be quite highly charged. And I'll point that out to you, what some of the problems can be, because that can completely prevent your nanoparticles from ever going into the cell. So let's talk first a little bit about some of the strategies for stabilizing biocompatible coatings to the core material. Again, if we think about the core material is mostly going to be hydrophobic, then we can basically absorb a lot of things to the surface. And that's the most common way that people get started with either amphiphilic polymers that can also change their charge properties a little bit. You can have highly hydrophilic ones that also, you see there's a phobicity here where you have polar and nonpolar regions to create a structure which overall complex on the outside is hydrophilic. You can also link spacer molecules onto the surface to get things out away from the surface. And we're going to learn that the surface properties, particularly as if you use very small nanoparticles, it gets very tight in here. You don't have a lot of real estate to work with to do your surface chemistry. And some of the particular things like quantum dots, you may have 100 total binding sites as possibilities, and you've got to use those very carefully. Okay, so the two main strategies for doing the surface chemistry are covalent bonding and non-covalent bonding, and there are really advantages and disadvantages of each. And it's interesting because you tend to think every time you have an advantage that there's going to be a flip side to that and a disadvantage. So let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, the advantages of covalent bonding strategies, you're going to get a very stable structure. And that can control the process of bond disruption. You can have a covalent chemistry that is sensitive to an enzyme. It can be sensitive to pH changes such that the layer can be disassembled in the proper environment. So with a covalent chemistry, you can make those bond breakages very, very precise. However, you can also make the structure so stable that it's very difficult to assemble. So that layer may never come off, and it might have to come off if you have a multi-step targeting process and or you want to release drugs into the cell. And the other thing is, and you have to be very careful how you achieve this covalent bonding chemistry. And I can tell you from working with chemists for many years, the chemists always want to use very strong organic solvents because that's what they are used to using. And we have to, those are in general very non-biocompatible, and a few parts per million of contaminants of strong organic solvents left in there can come in and just destroy everything and kill any cells that they come into contact with. We're used to that. A few parts per million is enough to cause real problems to human cells. So whatever you put in, you want to be very careful that you can get it back out, even if it's at trace concentration. So in general, when we do covalent chemistry strategies, we want to use what we call aqueous chemistry, or soft chemistry sometimes it's called that way. And sometimes it's a little less precise, and sometimes it's a little less stable. But again, I think you can already see that when we're making this structure, we want it to be stable, but not too stable. You want it to be able to reconfigure it when the proper time comes. And sometimes those covalent bonds can just be too hard to break. So let me give you an example of a fairly simple covalent chemistry that is very commonly used in the field. And in fact, quite often, if you do start with commercially available nanoparticles, quite often they will come with so-called carboxyl or amine groups on the surface. What they've done is given you an initial hook. They've done the chemistry to attach the amine groups and the carboxyl groups to the surface, the nanomaterials. And then they've given you that hook to go ahead and use. And one of the things that you can do, then they'll tell you, well, why don't you just use carbodiamide chemistry to conjugate things to that, like peptides, like antibodies. And it's a very simple aqueous chemistry that will avoid any harsh solvents. And basically almost, you know, anybody can do this kind of chemistry. So this shows a cartoon is this particular one has a nanoparticle with a carboxyl modified surface. Again, a lot of these are commercially available. And then you can do this chemistry to be able to attach various things and give yourself basically another hook at the end of that so that you can go on for the next step. And the same thing is if you have amine modified nanoparticles. So this nice slide is courtesy of Christy Cooper in my group, who's our bioanalytical chemist. So we do this reaction a lot because it's very simple, fast, and easy. Non-covalent chemistry is usually some form of electrostatic or hydrophobic, where you're using that to draw to basically cause things either to fold or otherwise assemble in a fairly reversible fashion. Now, the advantages are those are typically thermodynamically driven. They're very gentle chemistries. It can be a very simple layer by layer assembly. I showed you last time with the zeta potential lecture. People will use polyanion and polycation polymers and do layer by layer assembly. That's the simplest, perhaps the simplest form of that. But there are also a number of chemistries where you simply are taking advantage, if you're in a hydrophilic environment, of taking hydrophobic and hydrophilic materials. And the hydrophobic materials are going to try to fold in to avoid the water and have the hydrophilic on the outside. So you can actually bring things inside other structures and effectively create an ordered assembly of materials just based on hydrophobicity. These are also easier to disassemble as multi-layered structures that can be a good thing or a bad thing depending on how stable they are. These structures, electrostatic ones, are going to be particularly sensitive to ionic strength and pH. So you will see some structures, a lot of them in the literature, where people use this in terms of low pH disassembly of these electrostatic bound structures to release a drug near the surface. So that's why they do that. They may be very stable at a pH of 7.2 or 3 in the blood, but when they get near a tumor, at, let's say at pH 6, then these structures just kind of fall apart and then can release a drug or the next layer, make it available. So this is a very good thing if it happens in the right order and keeps you on target. But it can be a bad thing if they're sufficiently unstable. And so you have to be careful and test this. And the good thing is you can test a lot of these things in vitro and know what kind of pH environments you're going to have to face. So you can do that. And remembering that the zeta potential can very suddenly change as layers spontaneously come off. Particularly, that's one reason why while my group started doing a lot of layer-by-layer assembly with polymers, with various collaborators, we became a little disenchanted with that approach, because as you peel off a layer, then all of a sudden you can go from having a negative zeta potential to having a positive one. And that positive zeta potential remaining particle may start sticking to everything in its vicinity. So you have to be a little careful with that, particularly if you're doing layer by layer assembly. So here, giving you a few examples here. Here's four common approaches to making a hydrophilic surface modification for quantum dots, because quantum dots are very hydrophobic. They're semiconductor materials. They do not like water. And to get them to exist in a water environment, you really have to try a number of these typically of hydrophobic, hydrophilic molecule, this ordering around them. So there are four different strategies here, some of them based on some simple thiol chemistry at the surface, but then giving rise to a lot of hydroxyl groups and so on the surface, which then make the overall coated structure relatively hydrophilic. You can also form a very stable silene shells with cross-linking agents and build structures on these, such that the outer portion of those complexes are now hydrophilic and will exist very nicely in water. And lastly, you can do, simple stabilizations with PEG and other polymers, and those will tend to, again, orient themselves so that their hydrophilic portions are facing outward and their hydrophobic ones are inner. And they'll just self-assemble themselves around the quantum dot structures. So these are very quick, common ways that people will take something like a quantum dot. And typically, as earlier in lectures, I showed you that the quantum dots were on the order as you go from blue to red. They may be, for example, maybe 4 nanometers when they're blue and maybe 7 nanometers in diameter when they're red. But if you actually measured them by dynamic light scattering and zeta sizing, you would find that they're typically about 12 to 14 nanometers. And the reason for that is that this shell that you build by one of these techniques around there forms a new hydrodynamic radius for the overall complex. And that's what you'll actually measure as it moves in a solution in a dynamic light scattering regime. Here's an example where we can take a polyethylene glycol complex and put it on an iron oxide surface, for example, and then have a sort of a bifunctional complex here. You see where we have this polyethylene glycol, and then we have folate coming up, and you can build complex structures. and then these become available for binding to folate receptors on cells. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about preparing the nanoparticle for addition for targeting and therapeutic molecules, and talk a little bit about some of the special requirements for these. And then lastly, as we go through this, how do we actually test it for efficacy at single cell level? So here's an example of aqueous dispersion of magnetic iron oxide nanoparticles, which again don't want to go easily into water unless they have some kind of a typically hydrophilic type molecules on the outside. So in this particular one, we're adding carboxyl groups to this, which allow them to become monodispersed here, as you see in a water environment. You can also add molecules which have hydrophilic side chains, and including special groups that you can add that are ready made for the subsequent chemistry. So here's an example where you're creating a structure which will not only go in water, but you have effectively the right hooks. You have also some, depending on some of these structures you see, would be probably very good at preventing some protein deposition on this, even if you, in the absence of for example, a PEG, so that you could end up with a structure which would probably coexist in the blood for a long time. Here's an example of actually taking quantum dots and actually taking thiol linkages to DNA oligonucleotides. And this is particularly nice if you think of the oligonucleotides, those could be aptamers, for example, for targeting. And they also, these oligonucleotides can be PCR amplifiable. So if you have the question of, you know, how do I detect a single nanoparticle present in a cell, then you have the possibility, when you have these oligonucleotides, of having PCR amplifiable regions that you can design primers to, and then actually detect the amplicons coming off of these structures. And you're going to have a lecture, guest lecture coming up from Tricia Eustachio in my group, who has invented some methods for using oligonucleotides, not so much on quantum dots, but on other, she's using various superparamagnetic iron oxide structures, but the same idea as this, and creating these kinds of structures. And here is a, you can actually modify PEG and put a methacrylate structure on that, and you can coat the particles. You can go through the chemistry and you can coat them with PEG, and then basically have a biotin molecule. And you'll see a lot of chemistry where people add a biotin molecule on and subsequently use avidin or streptavidin. Streptavidin being a better charge property form of avidin that doesn't stick all over everything. And in general, adding biotins on there and doing a biotin streptavidin type strategy is okay, and I would say it's good for quick prototyping, but you very quickly are going to run into a problem. And the problem is that the avidin molecule is pretty big compared to a nanoparticle. And so when you start to do this, pretty soon you've got an avidin molecules, structures that are much, much bigger than the nanoparticle inside, and the nanoparticle becomes buried among the streptavidins. And so it becomes a, you can do that as a first step strategy, but and you can, and people do this because streptavidin comes commercially available with a wide variety of fluorescent probes. And even some magnetic forms of streptavidin. But again, the streptavidin is very big. It has four binding sites typically per streptavidin. So you can get yourself into some interesting problems of steric hindrance. Quite often when you do this approach, you want to put a hydrocarbon spacer, typically about 12 to 14 carbons long, to get that biotin out there far enough away from the rest of the complex that the avidin can actually orient and bind to it. And if you don't do that, then you can very quickly find that the biotin is inaccessible and not able to be found. So you'll see biotin with spacer arm requirements. And again, you can buy biotin with spacer arms that go in as part of your reagent list that you can then attach those and do the chemistry. But again, don't get too carried away with biotin avidin chemistry. It's sort of a quick and dirty way to make things and prototype them. But that, again, in the spirit of this lecture, is going to probably limit you severely down the line in terms of your total design, because there's a lot of things that you're not going to be able to do after you add avidin. Let's talk a little bit about attaching different types of targeting molecules. So we've got a structure at this point that we've made it more or less biocompatible. We've made it so that it exists in a hydrophilic environment. We may or may not have added stealth molecules like a polyethylene glycol and maybe a bifunctional one, such that we can then attach a targeting molecule at the end of it. And those targeting molecules, as we've talked about earlier in the course, are typically in about four different forms of that. The first is antibodies. And again, antibodies have great specificity. You could buy a lot of them commercially available. And again, with the chemistry can be made particularly simple by some of these carbodiimide chemistries, for example, or thiol chemistries. The only problem, again with the antibody, is now you're making a structure, and I told you the real estate is pretty limited in there, and an antibody is a very big structure. It's typically about 180,000 to 220,000 daltons, kilodaltons. And that is a very large structure. And so therefore, you're going to be space limited in a hurry. And the steric hindrance problems can be huge. So a preference that I push a lot to people is peptides. Once you know what your antibody is, there are, in many cases, peptide equivalents. And those, more and more of those, are becoming commercially available so that you don't have to make your own. On the other hand, some people are making peptide libraries and then screening them so that you can come up with a peptide which has the same binding structure for an epitope as an antibody does. And these structures, peptides, can be very small. I showed you earlier in the course a peptide targeting molecule that we used for a breast cancer cell line that was only 7 amino acids long. And that same peptide also had, what we would call a cell permeant peptide that would actually take it across the cell membrane, all for 7 amino acids. That's pretty good return on your per amino acid in terms of function. And they're also be not as immunogenic. When you add an antibody, we talked about earlier that in general the antibodies are made in mice to make monoclonal antibodies. And if you're going to put these into humans, you're going to have to spend a lot of time and money so-called humanizing the sequences, as I talked about in an earlier lecture. And that no longer becomes a cheap antibody. That becomes a very expensive antibody. And you've got to worry about immune reactions of the remaining mouse sequences. So a way you can avoid that, again, with both the peptides and the aptamers, is to design sequences which are very non-immunogenic, and you don't have to worry about causing anaphylactic shock in the human that you're giving this to. The other thing about the aptamers, again, those aptamers can be either DNA or RNA aptamers. They can be PCR amplifiable. They'll typically have a high negative charge, and that's I alluded to earlier about the possibility of making those PCR amplifiable and using those for a nano barcoding structure. The only problem is as you do that, you start adding a lot of oligonucleotides, you're going to have a very high negative charge. And one of the graduate students in my group just had measured the one of her constructs, and she was having a zeta potential of minus 50 millivolts. Well, that's nice when it's a bottle on the bench It's not very nice when you try to have it bind to a cell surface. It means you're going to need a heck of a lot of a binding targeting molecule to reach across that much of a potential barrier. So when you have if you get a very high negative charge, which sometimes can happen with oligonucleotides and aptamers, then you may have to add some positive charges back. There are a number of different positively charged molecules you can do to bring the zeta potential back down to something in the range of -15 to -20 millivolts. And lastly, you can do, and I showed you in a previous slide, how you can actually hang a folate molecule out on the end of a polyethylene glycol, then make that, and then if you add that structure on the outside of a nanoparticle complex, then you can start trying to take advantage of the folate receptor numbers on various types of cancers that have elevated folate receptor numbers. So this is something to keep in mind. But you have to typically, if you're going to take a small molecule, you have to get it out there, and perhaps even with some kind of a linker arm to get it out so that it's spatially accessible. Okay, so in terms I mentioned earlier about soft aqueous chemistry, and quite often involving carboxyl or amine groups on the surface, again, this is the easiest thing. This is something, if you can possibly do it, I recommend it, because that means that you're not having to do any significant amount of chemistry. But watch out for the possibility that you might need a spacer arm to get it out there away from the surface enough to be able to link up adequately to antibodies and peptides. So you just have to keep that in mind. Here's an example of a superparamagnetic iron oxide nanoparticle where aptamers have been, targeting molecules have been bioconjugated to it. Your basic structure looks like this. This is a schematic of it, and you end up with this is trying to show the shape dependence of an aptamer, how it folds its structure to recognize a shape of an epitope like an antibody would. And then the way I included the gel in this figure from this paper also because you want to be able to show that when you make these complexes that they really are attached to the nanoparticles. And when you publish a paper or put in a grant, that's going to be one of the first things that a reviewer is going to look for, saying, how do you know that your aptamer or targeting molecule is actually attached to this nanoparticle? Because sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. And so what you'll typically do is put these on a gel, you'll show that in this particular case, we have in lane one, just a DNA ladder so that we can get some idea of sizing. We then know if we run the free aptamers down, we know what their size should be. If the aptamer is attached to a superparamagnetic iron oxide particle, it's always going to stay at the top of the complex and it's not going to migrate through the gel. So that's how you know, and you can then know that the aptamer, and you can do this very simply, since it's a DNA aptamer, that you can just essentially stain that with a DNA stain. There's a variety of the ones available to be able to light that up on the gel. So this is the way, and that's a standard way of proving it. You'll see always, that's why you'll see those in papers, because they're trying to satisfy that question. How do you know it's really attached? Okay, and that's one example of testing the complex. So the simplest way is if you can put it on a gel. You can show that it's attached, but the question is, now that it's attached, is it able to recognize the receptors on the cell of interest? Because it may be perfectly well attached and in some kind of a conformation process that it's stuck on there, but it no longer recognizes the epitope on the cell. So for that, you're going to want to look back to some of the strategies first by, if you have a, if this is a, let's say a fluorescent particle also, you can look and look through by fluorescence microscopy or flow cytometry or some kind of an imaging technologies where you can actually look at the individual cells. And again, you always want to be able to show that it targets the cell of interest. And that means by definition, you better have cells that it shouldn't target in there. And I've seen so many papers where they show, again, yes, it targets to those cells, and you wonder if it targets to every cell in the world, because they never showed that it didn't. And so you're going to want to either have a separate culture of cells that don't have that receptor, or do some kind of a labeling method such that you can make a mixed culture and you can see which cells are which and see if they target. And again, is the nanoparticle still attached to the targeting molecule? That's that gel experiment that I just showed you. Okay, if we attach different types here, and one of the types is of therapies that people have tried to make with nanoparticles is actually antibody therapeutics. So this would be a variation of the current antibody therapies that are available for about 20 different types of cancers. And I've mentioned those, for example, rituximab for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the issue there is that why would we want to take a nanoparticle approach? Well, in those cases, if you put bare antibodies into the immune system, then for those therapies, you require the patient to have a very active and functional immune system. So many of these people that they give the antibody treatments to, they also give chemotherapy to, which is, I understand why they do it. It's sort of like you throw everything that you can at the cancer early on, hoping to get an advantage on it. But they compromise the immune system, and then the antibody therapy doesn't work as well. In fact, sometimes it cannot work at all. So all of those standard therapies require a functioning immune system to go with that. And so if you have, if you put your antibody in a structure and you try to, let's say you try to increase its circulation time, try to prevent neutrophils from eating the antibody, so you put it in some kind of a stealth structure, but you still want it to be partially available, then you have to make sure that that antibody therapeutic structure still will interact not only with the cells of interest, but also with the rest of the immune system. Because it may bind to the cells, but the rest of the immune system may not be able to recognize it and then activate the rest of the immune process. So you want to be a little careful with that. Which is why, in general, what I have urged as an approach for you is to not require a functioning immune system. Nanomedicine does not have to have a functioning immune system. You can have something that's independent of that. And that's kind of nice, actually, because that means that you can actually pursue more than one strategy. You could actually do a strategy of chemotherapy or something and do nanomedicine at the same time. So one would not preclude the other. Okay, if you do a peptide therapeutic strategy, one nice thing about peptides, for example, if you want to kill the disease cells, then I've already indicated to you that killing cells in a process of so-called necrosis is not a very good thing to do. Necrosis means that you basically open up those cells and you spill their internal contents into the environment. Well, what happens when you do that is, first of all, you have some very toxic molecules inside those cells that are released to their neighbors. And if you actually try these experiments in vitro, you'll quickly see that many of the surrounding normal cells will be killed by what is released from the dying cell. So a better strategy of that is to actually use a peptide, and there are a number of peptides available because there are multiple apoptotic signal transduction pathways where you can take one of these apoptosis-inducing peptides and use that. So that, again, the advantage of that is that you can get away with very small numbers of nanoparticles, theoretically maybe even a single nanoparticle, which actually can trigger those apoptosis-inducing peptides, can turn on the apoptosis mechanism inside a cell. And then the rest of the process, as you know, is a process of breaking down all of the components of a cell such that they can be reused. So you're breaking down the cell into its basic amino acids and nucleotides, and then those can be just taken up by surrounding cells or easily discarded. And when you have necrosis, you have a strong immune response. Macrophages come in. You end up with this is when you have, for example, a cut and it gets infected, and you see a very ugly immune reaction. That's that kind of thing that happens during necrosis. And so what you really would like is something that, if you have an apoptosis, you would have something that would be almost seamless. In other words, in many cases, you would not see even a scar, scar tissue, as opposed to having a really bad scar caused by a combination of the initial wound plus the intense immune reaction at the site of necrosis. So this is something that I urge you to think about if you're trying to get rid of cells. Think about using an apoptotic mechanism rather than a really necrotic cell killing mixture. Therapeutic aptamers offer a number of advantages. Among other things, theoretically you could manufacture those inside a cell with a proper templating. So you could actually create a therapeutic aptamer inside a cell, and as we talked about in the beginning of the course, you could actually make a feedback loop and actually make a therapeutic molecule inside a cell. And that would be the easiest possible way to do that, because all you need is pools of endogenous nucleotides or RNA or DNA precursors. You can make transcribable sequences that are more complex, that gets around again the problem. You can create the sequence inside the cell rather than getting the drug delivery actually with getting the right dose. Because as I mentioned to you, and it's something people don't think about often, is how do you control the number of nanoparticles that actually get to the target cell? You know, and is there a threshold number? Do you have to have the amount of drug that, say, requires 10 nanoparticles or 50 nanoparticles to be a threshold to either kill the cell or cause some change in it? How are you going to control that? That's going to be a very difficult process. So if you can come up with a strategy that only requires a very small number and theoretically even a single nanoparticle to go in there and do its job, which you can do with some of these strategies, then that gets you around the problem of drug thresholds and getting enough there. Small drugs we are doing that. We're putting things like doxorubicin in into nanoparticles and delivering them. There's an advantage in terms of protecting cells which are not targeted. But again, getting the right dose is going to be tricky because you're going to have to deliver that dose inside the cell. And as we mentioned, since the cell is about a million times the volume, I say this over and over again, a million times the volume of a nanoparticle, even if you have a drug filling that nanoparticle, that drug is going to get, if you just leave it off at the cell membrane, it's going to get diluted a millionfold. So if you're going to use a small drug and be effective, then you've got to do probably some kind of intracellular targeting so that it becomes maximally effective and doesn't get highly diluted in the cytoplasm. Here's an example of a multifunctional nanoparticle which is giving an siRNA approach. So we're doing a gene silencing, and that's one of the references that I've given you. This particular one is using quantum dots. I think it's a nice design for the test tube, but probably not for in vivo human use. But it has the advantage, again, with being a fluorescent nanoparticle, and that's why people use them, that they can study them by fluorescence microscopy at single cell level. They can do confocal microscopy. You can see three-dimensionally where it goes, and then you can study things quite carefully. So again, it's a nice rapid prototyping tool, but you want to be careful that you don't go down that road too far. I've told you that there are what we call second generation quantum dots, made out of zinc and manganese and other non-semiconductor materials that are probably going to be biocompatible and approved for human use, but they're not there yet, but they're soon to be commercially available. And then a gene silencing approach. Again, this would be very useful for treating chronic diseases where you wanted to basically reprogram the cell and turn down the expression of certain molecules. And you can argue that that strategy might be very difficult, but if you think about why do disease cells end up having a different gene expression pattern, it's typically because they get nudged by environmental factors and they get walked over from one state, normal state, to some disease state. And if you can do something to push them back, you may get them into a process where they go from one state back to another state. So I don't think this approach of gene silencing probes is as far-fetched as many people think it is. That it may not take that much to be able to push it. And we have some examples of that where, about 10 years ago, I was thinking that it would take, maybe about 10 genes to be modified to make a stem cell, you know, an embryonic stem cell type situation, or a pluripotent stem cell. And what's happened since is that people have shown that you can, with as few as perhaps 4 genes, you can walk the cell from one state to another state to make it a pluripotent stem cell. So I think this approach has a lot of value in it for manipulation, and particularly in chronic diseases and where you want to reprogram the cells to do something a little different. And this may be a very good approach. A lot of people right now, I think, are a little hung up thinking that stem cells, you have to find the stem cells, take them out of the body, do something to them, and then put them back into the body. And if you start thinking about the problem, we're finding precursor stem cells in practically every organ of the body. And the reason that they're probably there is that they're there so that they can be called upon to help regenerate things in that organ. And the biggest problem we have is that most times we can't get the proper signals to those cells to tell them it's time for them to go do their job and regenerate some tissue. So if you want to think about the next, what I call the next stage of nanomedicine, would be regenerative nanomedicine, where you actually target nanoparticles to these cells and then give them the right signals to tell them that they need to turn on and actually do their function. And that way you find those precursor stem cells in the organs where they actually are, and then just provide the proper switching signals so that they know that they need to do a particular function. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about testing that overall nanoparticle therapeutic molecule complex. So now we have a device which may have a core material that we can use for some kind of multimodal imaging. We have some kind of a targeting mechanism and a stealth layer, and now we have one way or another some kind of a therapeutic molecule in there. So what we want to have is direct and indirect ways of testing those. So not only do we need to test the targeting by things like by flow and image cytometry, but what we want to do is we want to actually test a function of that cell. So now we know we've targeted the nanoparticles to that. What we need to do is come up with an appropriate assay to know that we have affected the cell in the way that we want it to do. So think about single cell assays, and then think about the biochemistry of what you're trying to change in the cell. Okay, and then come up with a strategy. And there are many cell labeling techniques where you can actually watch a cell change its state from let's say a disease state to a normal state with the addition of various therapeutic molecules. So you want to be able to think about that. You want to quantitatively assess, again, at single cell stage, because we're doing single cell medicine here. Again, is the nanoparticle still attached to the therapeutic molecule? That's one of the things that we have to test, because if this complex comes apart while it's circulating in the blood before it ever finds its target, then we've lost all of the benefits of the nanomedical approach of trying to encapsulate the therapy, deliver it to the right place, prevent it from being delivered to the wrong place. So trying to test that, is it still attached to the therapeutic molecule? And I'd say the biggest problem that a lot of people have is that they will test these in tissue culture. They'll test them in tissue culture medium. And then if you ask the question, well, what happens to that complex after 4 hours in blood? That's a very good question to ask, because blood has a lot of enzymes in it that break things down. And there are many, countless drugs and therapies which are great in tissue culture, and they just don't work in blood, because the blood neutralizes them, breaks them down in a very short period of time. So that's something that you always want to test. It's not that hard a test to do. You can get a peripheral blood sample pretty easily. That's not a huge human investigation challenge. And then test your nanoparticle complexes in actual human blood, because that's typically where it's going to go first, before it goes in as a therapeutic molecule. And then test that as a function of time. If you haven't done that, you can go a long way down a pathway and come up with a complex here, which is completely useless in an actual patient. So don't forget to test that. Is it still stable? Is it still able to be functional? Okay, and then lastly, let's chat a little bit about this. There's a lot of pharmacodynamics that is known. This has been something, you know, for the last 100 years or more, people have been studying this for molecules and diffusive molecules in the blood. And you can do that, and you can do that typically with radioactive tracers and a variety of methods. But very little is known about the more complex dynamics of nanoparticles. These things don't behave like diffusible molecules. And in fact, we don't want them to behave like diffusible molecules, because the standard process of delivering a drug to a cell in the body is that you have to get the local concentration. It's typically a concentration gradient to push it across the membrane, which means you have to have a fair number of molecules outside the cell. So our fundamentally different approach here in nanomedicine is that we don't want to do that. What we want to have is a relatively small amount of nanoparticles containing a drug outside a cell that we can increase its circulation time so they stay for a very long time. And then it's not concentration gradient driven across the membrane. It's taken across by either a receptor mediated uptake, or some kind of a peptide complex that takes things across the cell membrane very readily, and it doesn't require a drug concentration gradient. So that changes the game totally in terms of the amount of drug that you need and some of the problems. But it also changes the pharmacokinetics. Nobody really knows this, and this is a very, you might say, well, why haven't they done this? As you start to think about how you're going to actually do quantitative biodistribution in an animal or a human, it's a very difficult thing to do. And particularly, you're cutting down the concentration of these things. If you take a radioactive probe approach, which is what few studies have been done, then you're going to need to have a pretty hot radioactive probe if you're having a very small number of nanoparticles, if you're going to be able to detect it. And that's a little hard to justify in terms of a human. And you'd certainly want to have a lot of normal humans as well as disease humans. And then that raises a lot of ethical questions. So this is a real problem. I can't tell you how many people have written to me and asked for me to give them data. These are typically people who are mathematically trying to model these things, and I tell them, I'd love to give you the data, I don't have it. And it's very difficult to have that data. So in terms of some possible new approaches, in an upcoming lecture, you're going to see an in situ PCR approach to try to amplify some of the molecules inside a single nanoparticle into a million copies or more, so that you can actually see them make fluorescent amplicons, perhaps driven off oligonucleotide sequences that are attached to the nanoparticle surface, as a way to get around some of these problems and to actually see their distribution in tissue. But it's a very challenging problem, and therefore very little is known. And when you're doing these experiments, you do animal experiments, you may think that you just have to look at the tissues of interest. And obviously, if you have a tumor and you're watching nanoparticles go to that tumor, and you know exactly where that is, you can do histological sections and study that. But the question is, how do you study everywhere else in the body? That's a vast territory, and you're not going to have large numbers, so you're never going to see them. So it's a very, very different, but some very different, but difficult approaches. So with that, again, I've given you a number of references here that I tried to give you some ones that would give you some perspective on how to proceed, but some overall guidance for bioconjugation. So think about the total thing that you're trying to do, and don't let the initial chemistry steps dominate it to the point where you've thrown away all of the advantages that you might have by taking a different approach. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes.
So for the gene silencing approach, that's intriguing. So for tumors, yes, the silencing is probably to deactivate the tumor cells.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned for stem cell, it's also used. Is that for activating the stem cell, so to offset the
So the question, if I understand it, is with the gene silencing approach, you're asking about how you would use that for a tumor cell strategy, in terms of perhaps silencing genes which might be required for metastasis, you could also not only take a gene silencing, but you could take a gene promoting strategy on the other extreme to try to produce other molecules which might limit things like metastasis. I think the thing that I did not mention about gene silencing probes is that that's again one of those great strategies that works in the tissue culture plate, but most of the gene silencing probes will not survive as molecules in the bloodstream. So it becomes almost completely useless. But if you can encapsulate those inside of a nanoparticle complex, then you can deliver those in blood to the cell. And then once they're inside the cell, then you're in a totally different environment where they will work very much like that. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but if you want to reformulate that, I'll give it a try.
So for tumor, you try to silence it. But for stem cell,
you
try to activate
it. Yes. Okay. So the question or comment was that for tumor cells, you're probably going to be more into a silencing approach to shut certain things off, proliferation, metastatic potential, and so on. For a stem cell, as we talked about, for perhaps a regeneration strategy, then what you're really probably doing is trying to turn certain genes on to be able to activate, to build, to make that stem cell want to differentiate down a particular pathway and make the kind of cell that you need for regenerative medicine. So yeah, that would be more of and again, as I've mentioned to you, that there are we're learning quite a bit about that from the studies that are being published with induced pluripotent stem cells, and actually a surprisingly small number of genes. Initially, those were done with oncogenes, which caused people to worry a little bit, introducing oncogenes into normal stem cells. I think that probably is something to worry about. But now there are a variety of other gene strategies to trigger those cells and get them to grow into a more mature cell types that are needed for tissue and organ reconstruction. Other questions? Okay, well, if there aren't any more questions, I'll see you next Tuesday.